This is Phil Ferrand, and I am walking around. So happy 4th of July, everyone. It is the 4th. I'm off work, but I thought I'd go ahead and get this done today. I just came back from my little run, and I'm just going to walk down to the bridge in the back as I have done in down to the bridge and back as I have done in times past. Might be a little out of breath, but we'll be okay. Big day today, I'm hoping, as far as, well, first of all, work is fine. Everything's puttering along. We seem to be making progress on several fronts at the same time, and that's all good. So just lots of meetings and data decisions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, and that's my watch talking, because I still have it turned on from my run. I think I'm going to get another 5K in today. One of the times I did this, I had gone for my little run and then gone down for a walk. About halfway through my little walk, it said, "Congratulations on your first 5K." And I went, "Oh, okay." But anyway, so all is well at work. I'm compromising my writing schedule just a little bit this week. I am ahead. I do have extra words in the bank from when I did my first writing sprint for book 21. By the way, the production copies of book 20 came in. We're good to go on book 20. So just have a few more deliveries to make, but aside from that, we're good. So I'm back to book 21. I'm doing my read-through. Normally I do my read-through before the writing sprint starts, but I'm taking off a little extra time this week to work on my latest costume project, because it's not quite where I'd like it to be, but I'm not panicking yet. So the head of Marvin the Martian, which swivels and eyeballs move and he gets angry, that's taking a little longer than I thought it would, and it's going to be heavier than I thought it would. I went ahead finally and weighed it. turned out to be about, well, it's 15 pounds, but I'm not done. So I would guess it's going to be 20 pounds by the time it's all done, but I'm going to be carrying it on my shoulders. So that should be fine because the wings are 20 pounds. I can manage that, but I'm actually using a backpack with metal inside it, aluminum plates inside it, to with a waist strap to kind of stabilize everything, because that's what I have on the wings. So I'm working on getting that done. So the plan today is to spend the morning, you know, first 3 or 4 hours reading, trying to get a little farther along there on book 21, what I already have written it, and then I'm going to turn around and work on the Marvin the Martian costume. I think I'm okay. I think I'm still okay. If I can get the backpack and the supports and all that stuff working in the afternoon, then I have the evening to start on the helmet. The helmet, from a construction standpoint, is really simple. There's only like 4 or 5 pieces to it. Well, 5 pieces to the actual helmet, 4 pieces. And then, of course, I got to make the brush thing on the top. But again, it's all just basic shapes. So all I have to do is scale it up and secure it. And then get it supported enough to where it will just hover outside the actual ball that's Marvin the Martian's head so that it can swivel freely inside that. So, but I think I have that all worked out. I think we'll find out. And I think I have enough materials to get that done and et cetera, et cetera. And then once we get that all done, get it mounted, then I've got to just finalize the pulley system inside. I decided this last week that I really didn't need to do anything complicated on as far as the motion goes. I should just put pulleys in there and have one string to pull down the angry eyebrows and one string to pull up the angry eyebrows and then another string to make the eyes go down. You know, don't worry about linkages, just do a little puppeteering and make it simple. So I think that's all worked out. And then once I get that done, then it's a dead run out for the rest of it. But the little skirt with the segments, those are just the same thing over and over. Painting is easy. Shoes should be pretty easy. They're just rounded off rectangles. They'll be big, but they'll be fairly easy. And then the gun is really just block shapes, so that should be easy. I don't think I'm gonna be able to grocery shop in this thing. And I don't know, I've had it on and I've looked through it and I can see somewhat, but I'm not really sure how much I'm gonna be able to see. I don't think I'm gonna be able to grocery shop, so it's gonna be one of those things that I'm gonna do a tour through the store and then pull it off and head back in to actually get my grocery shopping done. And I'm thinking at that point that I'm just gonna make myself a quick Marvin the Martian helmet. And I've got some kind of Marvin the Martian sunglasses coming in that I can put on. And I think that'll be fine while I'm grocery shopping. So give me a chance to interact with people a little bit more after the Marvin the Martian thing. So it should be fun. It should be fun. I don't quite have all the bit memorized yet, but I've got almost a little over 2 weeks to go. So I think that'll be fine. It's a gorgeous day. Sun is out. I don't know what the temperature is, but man, the sun is out. It's a beautiful day. We had some rain last night, and so the leaves are still dripping with water a little bit, and I'm trying to get some sun. So, this last week, I've just been watching more and thinking more about this whole malevolence situation. And it's really been interesting to me to hear others discussing malevolence as well, that are far out of my sphere of influence. Because it seems like anyone who's of a certain ilk, where they're looking around in the world and they're seeing patterns and they're saying, what in the world? What? They're seeing the same things, and then they get together and start talking with each other and they start nodding their head and going, yes, yes, yes. And it's again this whole idea that I think I talked about last week or the week before last, that there is not an adequate explanation if you're trying to explain all of this away through ignorance or apathy or intimidation or greed, any of those things, or incompetence, you know, any of those things are not really sufficient, because there's an animosity underneath it all. And this last week I was listening to Tucker Carlson's podcast, and he was interviewing Matt Taibbi. And Matt Taibbi was talking about his experience in journalism, and he's lived an interesting life, and his reactions to things. His dad was a journalist, kind of old school journalist. He said one of the great things about my dad is that he could talk to anyone. He said he'd show up on, you know, the scene of fires or crimes or that kind of stuff, and just in no time he's talking to them all, getting their various perspectives. You know, he was an old school journalist where he actually went out, talked to people, wrote a story, you know, kind of left his own feelings and his own persuasions out of it. And Matt Taibbi was saying he didn't think he could ever do that because he wasn't that good talking with people. But early on, somewhere in there, he fell in love with Russia. He fell in love with the culture. And along the way, he and Tucker Carlson were talking about the fact that, what is this thing that we're told that you're just supposed to hate all the people in another country? Tucker Carlson was saying, that never made sense to me. Never made sense to me why I was being told to feel something about people that I don't even know. I'm down to the little bridge. I always like to stop and listen to the water a little bit because this is just a gorgeous setting. Listen to the birds. Enjoy the sun. We've had enough rain here recently that it is flowing nicely. The other side of the bridge, which I'm crossing to now, is much calmer, much stiller. But then it goes under the bridge, drops a little bit, and into the rocks, and it's very good. It's very, very good. So anyways, Matt Taibbi was talking about the fact that he had fallen in love with the Russian comics and those writers, and he said he went over to Russia to work as a stringer. And that's my watch talking again. Which means that he was just over there kind of on his own, pulling together whatever kind of stories he could pull together and then selling them to newspapers. And of course, in the process, learned Russian. He knew some, but he learned more. But one of the things he said that was really funny is he said, you know, I grew up in America, and at the time, young people were expected to succeed and go out and find jobs and, you know, build homes and families and yada, 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 yada. And he said, I was always kind of depressed growing up. And he said, I got over to Russia and everybody was depressed. And he said, I fit right in. So he had a lot of very, very interesting situations happen when he was in Russia. And he saw firsthand what communism was like. He was, you know, saw the excesses, Brezhnev. He was there when, I think, and he knew Putin was in government at the time. And so, you know, we could kind of watch and see what that was doing. He did note at the time that most of the Russian bureaus for the major media companies, they would all kind of stay confined in this one little Americanized section. And then they would get fed whatever news stories they were supposed to do. None of them spoke Russian, which shocked Tucker Carlson. He said, how can you go over and report on a country like Russia unless you know the language? And he said, yeah, they didn't know the language. And what Matt Taibbi saw at that point was that you just had this apparatchik of a news media that was just sitting there being fed stories by whatever, and then they just wrote those stories up. And so there, and you know, this was, when was this for him? I think it was like the 90s or something like that. So then eventually he did come back home and he got a job with Rolling Stones. And so he had a chance to kind of compare what was going on in Russia and what was going on in America. And he found more commonalities than he thought he would find in terms of the media moving towards a very singular position, just repeating what they're told, et cetera, et cetera. It was interesting, he had noted that he did come back and eventually was covering the campaign when Barack Obama ran for the first time. And he said he was a big Obama fan. He said the whole thing was, you know, pitched as, this is our great hope and we're finally over racism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But he said, that very quickly, after Obama had gotten in office, everything turned. And, you know, he just kind of brought in the old guard from the Clinton era, and he just did what they told him to do, and they, you know. And of course, Obama was facing the financial crisis at that time, and, you know, that was difficult. And basically, Obama was told, if you don't do exactly what we tell you, you're going to bankrupt the country, and you're going to destroy everything. Well, okay, you know, this guy hasn't had that much experience actually running anything, and so what's he going to do? He's going to listen to those guys. And I guess Matt Taibbi did write a big article in the Rolling Stones called Obama's Big Sellout, and that didn't win him any points with the Obama administration. So then he was observing more and more that there was getting to be an erosion of freedoms and justice in America, and he was watching it happening. One of the things that he was very shocked over is that apparently the intelligence agencies, see, and I should pay more attention to this, had targeted Anwar al-Awlaki, who was an American citizen. And the intelligence agencies just killed him without a trial during the Obama administration. And at that time, you know, Matt Taibbi just couldn't believe that the government could justify legally killing an American citizen without due process. And he feels like that set a dangerous precedent, because he knew, as does anybody if you study it all, that the American government has been involved in multiple places, an abundance of places, overseas, toppling governments, setting up governments, killing dissidents. But what he was seeing is that the American government was now turning all those tools on its own citizens. And it was interesting because he saw a bunch of this stuff happening, and it was all because there were populist movements. They were discussing the fact that the American government seemed to reach a point where they didn't like populist movements. They wanted people to do what they were told. And so he saw a lot of events that led the intelligence agencies to view the American citizens and anyone involved with these movements as enemies to America. And he went back much farther than I was expecting. I mean, he was talking about populist movements like Occupy Wall Street, you know, the Tea Party, the Arab Spring, and especially things like Brexit and the Trump presidency, that the intelligence agencies just looked at all this as, you know, we've got to stop this, we've got to tamp this down, we got to get this under control. And so he saw a lot of that forming up. And then, of course, at one point, Elon Musk buys Twitter, and they contact Matt Taibbi and others to say, you want to come look in the basement? Come look in the basement. And then, you know, all of it comes out that, yes, the intelligence agencies were having direct meetings with the social platforms and tell them, oh, check out this guy, check out this guy, and you should really review this, and we don't think you should be talking about this and that and the other. And this was happening before COVID, you know. And you see things happening then where the intelligence agencies are supposedly doing things that are supposedly illegal. It is definitely a suppression of speech by the American government. Of course, the amazing thing is people hear about all that stuff and they shrug and they go on. It's like, oh yeah, I guess they would do that. You know, and there's no accounting for it. So it's all very interesting as he was talking about all that. But in the midst of all those discussions then, they started talking in larger, broader terms about what they felt like was driving all of this. And of course, Matt Daibbi has an interesting perspective because he lived in Russia. He lived under the communists. He saw it firsthand. And what both of them concluded at one point was that, yeah, this isn't incompetency. You know, it's not apathy. It's not take a couple of breaths here. It's not greed. It's not any of those things. It's not because they're idiots. It's malevolence. It's true malevolence. And honestly, if you want to see malevolence on display, there's plenty of displays of malevolence around the world with all kinds of governments, especially in communist countries. Because there's just an incredible amount of oppression that communist countries levy on their citizens. There was a really interesting special that I watched months and months ago about, everybody talks about the Nazi concentration camps, but no one talks about what Russia did to its citizens and does to its citizens. No one talks about what China does to its citizens. And what's interesting about all of this to me is, as we talked about, I think last week, we were talking about Karl Marx, is the connection, my watch is going off again, is the connection between communism and a far more primal, far more primitive, far more ancient approach to life. And that, of course, is Cain and Abel. And it's all built on envy. And that envy ends up creating such malevolence within a person that eventually the only resort is violence and murder for those that are supposedly the oppressors. This is an old, old story that has gone on forever, and it shares characteristics with all of the incarnations of this story. And so it doesn't matter whether it's all the way through to classical communism, it always ends up malevolent. It always ends up murderous. And it doesn't even matter whether it's just a communistic ideal based on race or based on gender or based on identity, any of those things. Wherever you embrace this oppressor-oppressed narrative, you're going to see the same manifestations. Wherever you are trying to exert control because you are envious or because you have decided that someone should not have the capacity to live the way they want to, and you've decided that you're just going to enforce your will on everything else, which is also a part of the Cain and Abel story, because Cain wanted to do things his way, and he wanted Almighty God to conform himself to what Cain demanded. So that kind of megalomaniacal approach to life is all part of the Cain and Abel story as well. And what you see is these engines in the world that drive towards the same goals with the same tactics. So, you know, given that, I am back home, by the way. We have a little bench out in our front yard, and it sounds like we have a woodpecker off to the distance. There he is, looking for food. Which, of course, woodpeckers are an amazing mechanical structure, but that's a whole other story. So what can we learn then? What can we expect knowing this? What predictions can we make knowing that the same engines, the same feelings, the same approaches in life that have the archetype of Cain and Abel, what can we learn as we look down the years of the history of the earth and history of countries, as we look through the communist experience? What are our destinations here? What's happening? Well, there's a really, really interesting laboratory experiment that we're running right now. And it comes down to right now how much power the apparatchik, the Goliath, as Brent Weinstein calls it, or the Goliaths, how much power are they willing to cede? What do they see as a threat? I think this is the first podcast that I've done since the presidential debate between Trump and Biden. And it's been fascinating to watch the sudden concern, to watch the about faces, to watch the, I mean, stuff that most people were paying attention to and saying, yeah, there's, you know, we just need to put Biden out to pasture because this is elder abuse. You know, this poor guy, just get him off the stage. And that's been evident ever since the election. And yet there were so many people in media and politics, oh no, he's never been stronger. You know, he may fumble his words a little bit in public, but behind closed doors, he's sharp and he knows exactly what he's doing and he's a decision maker. And, you know, then we have the debate and then it starts to come out like, well, yeah, he only works like 6 hours a day, but he's good from about 10 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon. It's like, what? And now the major news media is everybody's shocked. How could they hide this from us? It's like, come on. But the apparatchik seems to be turning now. The whole thing seems to be turning now against Biden. And the question is, can they shove him out? I mean, back in the 2020 election, they certainly shoved out Bernie. They got everybody else to drop out of the race. And then, you know, so Biden got the nomination. They just shoved him off the stage. And then the larger question is what will the apparatchik be willing to do? Because now you've got a really interesting set of conditions here. You've got Donald Trump that the apparatchik seems to hate. I mean, hate. Trump derangement syndrome is a very real thing, and even liberals, I've listened to liberals look at it and say, yeah, they just really hate that guy. So you have that threat. You don't want Trump to get in, supposedly. And now there is really a concern that Biden cannot pull this out. that too many people have seen what was clear all along, that Biden is in a state of mental decline. And yet up to this point, as of July the 4th, 2024, Biden keeps saying that he's not stepping down, that he is the nominee, and that he's going to run, and he's going to, you know, now they keep talking about, oh, he's meeting with these people, and he's meeting with that people, and he's listening to them, but all of that presumes that Biden is going to approach this from a rational standpoint. And I don't think he is. You know, he's lied and connived and had been hot-tempered, and I just don't think he is. He doesn't care about the Democratic Party. He does. He wouldn't have been doing all the things he was doing with his son traveling around picking up bags of cash if he cared about his reputation in the Democratic Party. What he wants is the power, and his wife seems to want the power as well. And so, and the family is quite content for him to keep the power because, you know, there's underhanded deals going on all the time. So you've got all that going on where there's, I don't think there's any way that his family is going to want him to step down. And I don't think there's any way that the old guard of the Democratic Party, maybe they'll turn on him too, but it's going to be fascinating to see. So then the question is, okay, so if he refuses to step down and his poll numbers keep dropping and there is an apparatchik in the country, this massive machine that has a malevolent end in mind, and Trump actually constitutes a threat, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. certainly constitutes a threat to it, and it is in line with all of the things that created despots all around the world, including the communist parties, and the terrible atrocities that go on in the communist countries, then what's next? Based on all that, what's next? I am not a prophet. I am not saying that this is a prophecy, but this is simply the application of that which a simple systems analysis can output. What are we facing ahead? These are the things that would not surprise me. It would not surprise me if RFK continues to gain steam, which he might now that Biden is seen as a bad option, because obviously RFK is an old school liberal and he attracts a lot of people who are both liberal and conservative. And if they hate Trump, if the liberals hate Trump, and they just don't think there's anywhere way that Biden can win, maybe out of desperation, they start voting for RFK. So if RFK starts surging in the polls, I've said this before, it would not surprise me at all if he's assassinated. I mean, they did it to his dad. They did it to his uncle. Why wouldn't they assassinate him? I got to stop. I got to get going here. So you've got that potential out there. I think the same issue exists with Trump. If Trump continues to improve in the polls, at what point does the apparatchik just assassinate Trump and throw the whole election into question? But now, whereas Biden was pretty safe, now I think Biden has put himself in that same position if he refuses to step down. So I was listening this week, and supposedly, I think it was Nevada and Michigan, that the deadline has already passed for making changes on the ballot, and the only provision is that If someone is declared incompetent or dies, they can replace them on the ballot. And there are others who have been talking about the fact that, well, everything's signed up, the rules don't allow anyone else to be put in because he's won the votes, and et cetera, et cetera. So again, if they can't get him to step down, theoretically, because of the rules of the Democratic Party, they can't force him out. But again, there is a provision made that in the case of incompetency or death, that they can have a brokered convention, but that has to happen after their convention in August. So a lot of interesting things to watch for there. You know, are they... The problem is, if you declare him incompetent, then the country is going to call for the invocation of the 25th Amendment. And if that happens, Kamala Harris becomes president. Ooh. And I don't think anybody wants that, except for a few diehard fans. I mean, that would make her the first president. It would set her up for life. So it's really fascinating. And I think there are already discussions in circles of the apparatchik, mostly in the intelligence agencies, that if needed, Joe Biden might just suffer a heart attack or suffer a stroke or suffer some other kind of death that looks like death by normal causes, but in fact it isn't. And I was talking to my wife about this, and she was saying, well, yeah, but they're going to have find some way to blame it on Trump. And I said, oh, right. No, that's exactly right. They will have to do that. So it'll be that Joe Biden died from the stress and the pressure of campaigning because of how ugly and how terrible and the things that Trump was saying about him. And he realized he didn't have the strength anymore and to actually win the presidency. And that caused such stress in him that drove him to a stroke or a heart attack. And it's all Trump's fault. So that truly is probably what the spin will be if Joe Biden mysteriously dies. So it's going to be really interesting to see. And, you know, some people might be thinking, well, you're talking about America. That wouldn't happen in America. That wouldn't happen in America. Well, this really isn't the America that is reflected in the Constitution and in the Declaration of Independence. Because when you have government, business, media, entertainment, that has all concluded that at least half of the country are worthless deplorables, and they should be shunned, and they should be punished, and they should be canceled. And in some cases, in the more extreme side of the apparatchik, they should just be killed. When you have that, you really don't have America anymore. And so it's going to be really interesting to see, because the apparatchik has extended all the way down into the voting. It's extended all the way down into the voting across the entire country. There were too many oddities that have been pointed out, too many things that there is hard evidence to stand behind them. And everyone has just shrugged and said, well, it's over now. There's nothing we can do about it. And just moved on. That's the apparatchik. So anyways, interesting times. Very, very interesting times. But for now, I got to go grab a shower. Need to get some reading done. Sorry, this was so long. I didn't have a shut off here somewhere. And then I got to work on Marvin the Martian, and we'll just see if we can make this sucker work. Have a great day, everyone. Happy 4th.